Let's see, how will we do this? It's not always easy to talk about visual matters on the radio. Of course, we'll use what makes most sense for us, and that is sound. This is, when it comes right down to it, all about listening in the broadest sense. And we seek out French composer Charles Koechlin, who was captivated by Charlie Chaplin, though not by silent pictures. Koechlin thought that whole package was superficial and much too conventional. And yet, there were the stars. There was just something about these actors that was richer than their characters and the stories would allow them to portray. And Koechlin was inspired to create portraits of a sort of some of his favorites, to use his musical craft to go deeper, to reveal more about these legends. This, Douglas Fairbanks. And Greta Garbo and Marlene Dietrich among them in his Seven Stars Symphony. Also from the Seven Stars Symphony, here's Lillian Harvey evoked in music. Edward Rothstein writes in the New York Times that Koechlin sketched her with winds playing fugally in their upper registers. One imagines her feet hardly touching the ground, a tilt of her head, the swirl of her skirt. Ah, lovely, rich, ear-catching, really. And Koechlin wanted to end the work with Charlie Chaplin, though not the cliché image of Chaplin, as Michel Fleury tells us. Again, Koechlin wanted to evoke more of Chaplin's inmost reality, and went more for his elegance and simplicity. Even allowing in some dissonant harmonies to suggest the complexity of Chaplin's character. And it all came from Koechlin's listening to these characters, whether they were talking on screen or not, absorbing in some way a sense of their essence, as he perceived it anyway. And in order to do that kind of creative listening, Koechlin once explained to the BBC, the artist needs an ivory tower, not as an escape from the world, but as a place where he can view the world and be himself. These are words we'll want to remember as we meet John Cashed. The artist needs an ivory tower, not as an escape from the world, but as a place where he can view the world and be himself. John Cashed is a caricature artist whose satirical drawings have appeared on book covers, billboards, Broadway marquees, and more than a few cocktail napkins, as he tells us. Also in the New York Times, Rolling Stone, Esquire, GQ, Time, Newsweek, New York Magazine, The New Yorker, The Washington Post, The Wall Street Journal, and on and on and on, and in Mad Magazine, too. In recent years, John has produced multimedia features for websites and digital publications, adding another dimension to his trademark examinations of political and celebrity culture. His art has been the subject of documentary segments for the Smithsonian Institution, public television, and the Discovery Channel. 24 of his works are part of the collection of the National Portrait Gallery in Washington, D.C. Sometimes John's caricature subjects actually become fans of his and acquire their caricatured likenesses. Among them, John Travolta, Ken Burns, Sean Connery, Rosie O'Donnell, Conan O'Brien, Stephen King, Joan Collins, Ted Turner, and Katharine Hepburn. John's work is showcased in several monographs of pop culture portraiture, notably The History of Caricature, The Savage Mirror, and Rolling Stone, The Illustrated Portraits. John is a faculty member of Marywood University's graduate program in illustration and design, and though he hails from the Midwest, he has settled here in northeastern Pennsylvania, and he will have an exhibition that opens tomorrow at the Everhart Museum in Scranton, running through May 7th, Making Faces, Portraits by John Casht. John Casht and Neshka Pfeiffer, curator at the Everhart Museum, paid a visit to the WVIA studios to talk with us about the show and John's ties to northeastern Pennsylvania.
My road to northeastern Pennsylvania goes directly through my wife, Dolores Matichka, who was born in Honesdale, and we met in Washington, D.C., and moved to Honesdale after years and years of visiting her family. We finally moved here in 2002.
Do you feel that it's home?
You know, actually, I don't, to be perfectly honest. I was born in Wisconsin. I lived in Denver, then I lived in London, then I lived in Washington, D.C., so I'm not sure what feels like home exactly. Strangely, Waukesha, Wisconsin still feels kind of like home, even though I moved away when I was 18.
Well, in Waukesha, were you there in grade school driving teachers wild because you were doing things in the margins of
Yeah, that was pretty much me. I went to a Catholic grade school. I have to say I was a good kid, actually, but I was also the typical artist sitting in the back of class making pictures of the teachers. Some of my first caricatures were of the nuns in Catholic grade school who I drew in various stages of undress. They surely deserved better than that, but I think it was my reaction to what seemed to be a pretty repressive environment in Catholic school, and, you know, I was just having fun with it. But I made a nun-a-month pinup calendar, and the principal was the centerfold, and it was a bit of a pivotal moment for me because I had the experience of doing something that was, you know, naughty, I guess you'd say. And it was confiscated by a teacher who was not a nun, and I never heard anything about it. I was waiting for days to be punished, but nothing happened. And having nothing happen was the same as being praised for it. And I think that was my first little taste of being rewarded for being contrarian.
Did they have art history and did they have practical art
lessons? They had a lot of, it was a Catholic grade school. I went to Catholic schools all through grade school, high school, and college. I studied, in fact, to be a monk. I didn't go to an art school. So that's a direct route into a career as a caricaturist, right, through a monastery.
And family, anybody doing art or music?
My mother was what used to be called a Sunday painter. She had a canvas set up and she was always painting in her spare time. So painting and drawing was in the house. My father was a physician, but he wrote poetry. So, there was certainly a lot of creativity in the family. I don't know that I'd say we were an artistic family, per se. My grandfather owned a big band music club, so music was a part of the culture of the family. So a lot of creative stimulation. And in terms of being influenced by family early on, my own work being influenced, I have to say that I had a wonderful family for satire. So that definitely helped me out. Catholic schools in my family pretty much kicked me pretty far down the road to being a satirical artist.
If you're getting your work confiscated and not having any repercussions
for it. No ramifications.
Were you showing it to your best buddies?
Yeah, I was popular among the students, that's for sure. And what I realized later is that Nun a Month pinup calendar was probably popular in the teacher's lounge, too. I would bet you anything it was passed around and they were having a good laugh. You know, along the lines of taking kind of cheap shots a la Nun a Month pinup calendar, I have to say that's really not my MO these days. I really consider myself pretty much of a traditional portraitist, in spite of the humor and the exaggeration in my work. I really don't, I don't go out of my way to make people look bad or even to be particularly critical.
Well, what about, for example, when you were young, you must have had a camera?
I didn't. I was not a camera guy. I made films with a friend of mine. We had a little, I guess it was Super 8. I don't know. We'd go around making crazy movies, The Beast of Timberline Lodge, Invasion of the Brain Suckers, that kind of thing, you know.
How about writing? You mentioned dad and poetry.
I like to write very much. And right now I'm actually, once this show is up and running and traveling, I'm switching gears a bit from the daily deadline stuff that I've been doing for, good Lord, 3 decades now. I'm going to be doing a couple of books, a graphic novel, my first, which will combine my writing with my drawings. Really excited about that. And then a book that I can't actually say too much about, which is with a number of other illustrators. So I am bringing writing into the mix. I should have brought my written observations with my drawn observations years ago, and I'm finally doing it.
We're in Wisconsin with you, and you're launching out.
We're eating cheese and drinking beer and having sausages. Okay.
And then we go to Denver and Washington?
Yep. A little stop over in London for college.
Was that art?
I actually spent some time in a monastery in Yorkshire and studied filmmaking. My years there were kind of a hodgepodge. I thought that I wanted to live a cloistered life, which is strange to think back on. I wasn't actually particularly religious, but I was very interested in focusing intently on creativity, if that makes any sense. And I realized later that being a freelance illustrator was pretty monastic. So
you and your tools, right?
Yeah.
Like a scriptorium there.
Yeah.
Did the monastery have a collection of illuminations or anything like that, old volumes that might have been intriguing to your eye?
This is going to be very disappointing to you, but not that I'm aware of. They did make their own beer. I never know what to say about those years. It seems like it makes sense to me internally that I would have done that. I had always had an interest in, I guess, as an artist, just in the source of creativity, which rubs up against philosophy and theology, and that's what led me there. But looking back, when I tell people I spent some time in a monastery thinking about becoming a secluded, cloistered monk, it really doesn't make a lot of sense to other people. I understand that.
The idea of the monkdom is, in a certain sense, not only are you introspective in that way, there's silence. It's silence, but you're listening. And I think that to do the work that you have to do, you have to listen to people beyond the words that they say.
You know, that's true, Erica. I really understand what you're saying there. I think if I had a natural talent coming out of the womb, it was an ability to focus intensely and to observe and listen. You know, the particular skills involved, those were learned. And I'm mostly self-taught in those areas, and I can see my deficiencies technically. I wish I had gone to an art school in some ways. But I spent a lot of time as a young person alone, observing, drawing, in silence. And so, yeah, I understand what you're saying there. There is a connection.
And we know with portraitists, if we listen to those of you who work in that way, in your work, it's clear you're going beyond surface quirks and that way and revealing something about the interior of the person that we're...
That's the aim for any portraitist, and I do try to approach caricature as portraiture more than cartooning. I know that there's a misunderstanding often about what caricature is. People think of it as the thing that's done in 5 minutes as an entertainment at the beach or bar mitzvah or birthday party or whatever. But it's also there's a long, proud tradition of caricature within portraiture. Da Vinci was a caricaturist. He littered his scientific papers with drawings of the grotesque heads. Monet was a caricaturist before he became a noted painter. And Daumier is the one, obviously, who is the biggest, the one who did the most to make it into an art form unto itself, really.
Have you had a chance to get up close and personal with Daumier?
Yeah, spent a lot of time just staring at his work and his sculptures in particular. He was quite brilliant and paid the consequences. I mean, he was doing that work at a time and in a culture when there were consequences. He was jailed, as I'm sure you know, for his irreverence.
And we think about that when we think about you as a little 14-year-old and your political cartoons. If it had been a different country, you might have.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. The idea of a 14 and 15-year-old doing political cartoons, by the way, is kind of ridiculous. I wasn't a trenchant political observer at that age. It was just a way to get my caricature work out there. And I realized early on that I wasn't a political cartoonist. I'm not really that interested in opining and in commentary. I'm more interested in people and what we have to say about ourselves through how we hold ourselves and present ourselves outwardly. So really, I realized that I'm a caricaturist, yes, but a portraitist, not a commentator.
Is there anything in the Everhart collection that is remotely caricature-like?
We might actually have some Daumier, if I'm not mistaken, but we do have actually quite a bit of portraiture. So at some point, a little bit later, after John's show opens on the 2nd, we plan on opening a gallery that includes variations on portraiture in the museum collection. So like more static portraiture, but also and folk art portraiture, but also things that feature portraits that wouldn't necessarily immediately be designated that way. And John's show opens on February 2nd and goes to May 7th. And actually that evening of February 2nd is a Friday, first Friday. So we're sort of thinking it's going to be a first stop first Friday before everybody goes downtown in Scranton. They can come to the museum between 5 and 8 to see the show. And actually John will be there. He won't be in the galleries, but he'll be there if people want to meet him in our museum shop.
So, John, when we come to see you at the Everhart...
It's work from the last 30 years, and it really is a retrospective. And the show itself coincides with a bit of a page turn for me. I described wanting to go into more narrative work and explore putting writing and pictures together. I've been doing one deadline after another, primarily for publications, for over 3 decades. And having started at 14, I got to a point where I didn't burn out exactly. I didn't lose interest in the work, but I lost interest in doing work for publications, especially as deadlines became shorter and shorter and shorter. The problem with an illustration portfolio is that it's not a portfolio of the best you can do. It's the best you can do under the circumstances, and I want to explore what my best work looks like, and that involves writing.
We're sort of building up to the time that you began to evoke the images you're known for example, mm-hmm. the Bill Murrays and musicians and actors and actresses and so on. Was that, I've got it.
How did I get into caricature? Yeah. There's a direct line all the way back, as far back as I can remember. I never decided to get into it. It got into me somehow. And I know that's, you know, that sounds like a clever way of twisting it around, but it's the truth. As long as I can remember, I've been fascinated by the world around me and the people around me in particular. I remember following my parents' friends around, imitating how they walked, how they talked. I like to think it was cute. I was probably a pain in the ass. But that then turned into drawing the teachers at school, and not just as a way of acting out, but it was a developing urge or expression where I wanted to slip into other people's skin, see what the world looked like from their point of view, and then kind of give my take on it. And so those early inclinations, fast forward, it's really very much the same as what you see on the walls at the Everhart. I just stopped drawing the teachers and started drawing political and social celebrities.
The majority of the work, I'd say probably 90% of it, is finished. So it's a finished print of an artwork that was published in various formats. But John also has a handful of items in which you get to see his process. So where there's multiple sketches of a specific person. For some reason, I think you have a little man crush on Conan O'Brien.
Well, I do now. I'm not sure I did when I started. That was a project commissioned by the Smithsonian. They wanted a film for their educational outlets on drawing likenesses, and I convinced them to let me use Conan O'Brien as a case study because he has such a wonderful face for caricature, and he's 6.5 feet tall. I mean, he's really great to draw. So yeah, there's a lot of drawings of Conan O'Brien in there, and that shows process, and it shows obsession, certainly. Neshka, thank you.
Just saying. You might wonder, staff is wondering if there's a little bit of a man crush on Conan O'Brien.
Yeah, I wondered. After setting up still lives that looked like Conan, photographing them with my friend Greg Raymond, the terrific photographer, after figuring out how to make an emoticon, or an emoticone as I call it, using the exact combination of keystrokes that look most like Conan O'Brien, after toasting his face into bread, I decided that things had gone too far. I'm pleased there's a fair amount of process in the show, including a big wall of sketches. So people can see that this stuff doesn't just materialize, you know, brush to paper, boom, it's done. There's a lot of scribbling, there's a lot of searching, there's a lot of struggling, frankly, that goes on behind the scenes. And so I wanted this show to reveal that as well, especially for students who might come to the show and think, oh boy, you know, this is neat stuff. How is it done? Well, it's done not always easily, you know, through a lot of searching and struggling.
That would then take us back to what you were saying about your young life when you were following parents and parents' friends around and sort of mimicking them, perhaps, as you described
irritating
it.
Irritating them.
Do you, in fact, assume the life of some of the people you've rendered in this way to get to know them? Do you watch a film?
I do, yeah. I study people pretty carefully as time allows. Sometimes deadline assignments don't allow that much time, but ideally, I surround myself with all kinds of photos of the person. I can't call the person up in most cases and say, hey, drop by Honesdale and let's draw. But so I recreate a life drawing situation and I surround myself with photos of the person from all angles. I like to have vintage pictures in the mix as well so I can see what features the person was born with and which were acquired later. I really do make a study and then I watch video so that all the still photos make sense. And I find, while I'm drawing, I mean, to your question too, I do find myself making their faces. I do sense certain method acting happening where I will often be talking like the person. And, you know, it can get a little strange, I suppose.
But if you are as serious an artist as you are, despite mm-hmm. the aura around caricature,
yeah.
then you would do that. I have no question that what
yes.
we see is the result of that kind of process. Whether we know about that or not, I would be sure that you're inhabiting them in some way.
You know, I often describe it this way. I think I ingest people, I digest them, and I regurgitate them.
Have you done Katharine Hepburn?
Erica, you and I did an interview a dozen years ago, and I had at that time just had published in the New York Times an appreciation of Katharine Hepburn. I was lucky enough to have a life drawing session with her that spanned 2 days at her house, and I did a pile of drawings, some of which are on display at the Everhart. First time, actually, they haven't been exhibited anywhere. And I also wrote a story called Drawing Miss Hepburn that the New York Times published, and I did a little reading of that when I was here last. I know where you're going. You want to hear it.
Only if you are comfortable.
I just happen to have with me. This is an excerpt of a short story called Drawing Miss Hepburn about my surreal and giddy 2 days at her house drawing her. I'll just read a couple of passages, and it gives me a chance to do my Katharine Hepburn imitation, which I haven't done in a long time. I may be very rusty. Ignorant of how you're supposed to go about these things, I had simply written her a note, short and unpolished, basically, can I come to your house and sketch you? I remember ending with, how about it? And hoped she would remember me. A friend of mine who writes celebrity profiles snickered at my naivete. You can't just write to someone like that. These things have to be arranged. Not that it matters. She hates the media. I'd never thought of myself as the media. He rubbed my nose in it. Maybe your publicist will send you a nice photo. In fact, Hepburn must have liked my unrehearsed directness. She responded immediately. Like the thank you note I had received after giving her a portrait of herself years before, this one was typewritten on miniature stationery, punctuated only with dashes. It had been typed across a nearly expired typewriter ribbon. Some words were distinct, others only partially formed. The letters seemed to undulate on the page, eerily approximating on paper how they would sound in that distinctive quavering voice of hers. The half sentences, the dashes instead of commas or periods, it all called to mind her fragmented style of speaking. Dear John Cash, please call me during the week. I'll see how my schedule looks. As I perspired at Katharine Hepburn's door, balancing flowers, chocolates, paper, and pencils, I had a single terrible thought. I'm completely unprepared. Seated opposite the fireplace was the legendary Hepburn. She looked smaller than I expected and old and radiant. Her secretary mentioned that I had come with flowers. Oh, which ones? Miss Hepburn looked around. I noticed then that the room was filled with flowers. The secretary pointed to a small bunch of tulips, which before coming to rest in this room had seemed substantial. Oh, no, Hepburn erupted. That's just too, it's extravagant. You're either rich or a fool, and you don't look rich to me. It was a good performance. She sounded genuinely upset. She gasped and scowled. It's a beautiful day today, I said, looking out her large windows. Tis, she answered, chin in the air majestically. She asked if I had seen her garden. I got close to the window for a look. Down here, I asked. Well, she snorted, it wouldn't be in the sky, would it? Like the tulips, I seemed small in this room. I was auditioning. She was sizing me up. Tell me if you want me to do anything. Suddenly, Miss Hepburn turned on the charm. Tell me if anything is in the way and we'll move it. Should I pose? I can look here or there. She was animated and eager to please and seemed disappointed when I told her that I didn't require anything special. The prospect of being directed had clearly excited her, and now I was confirming her fears that this would be a boring afternoon. Just do whatever you would normally do, I said. Oh, I'll take a nap then, she deadpanned.
Thank you, John.
So that experience, the electricity, being in the presence of that, that has to affect the results of what you would do.
It's a very exciting situation to be in, especially I was a young man. I was 36. She was 88 at that point, I think. But it was very exciting. It was also very nerve-wracking. Drawing from life is a difficult thing for me anyway, especially since I've cultivated the habit of drawing from photographs. You know, paradoxically, I'm trying to recreate a life situation, which is the ideal, so you can really see the person and absorb their presence. And then when you actually have a life situation, when I actually have a life situation, I freeze up a little bit because I'm so used to doing it the other way.
And have you done images of her subsequently?
I have, and having seen her from life greatly informed the work that came later.
If there's somebody who is sensitive and can hear and see beyond and reveal not only to people who are looking at Katharine Hepburn, but maybe to Katharine Hepburn herself, something that she doesn't know about herself.
Along those lines, and that point specifically, I'll say at the end of our 2 days, I just offered. I said, Miss Hepburn, would you like to see the drawings I've done? And she said, oh, I think that would be a terrible idea, don't you? But you were talking about being sensitive and observing and, you know, reporting the findings through work. I can say that it's an ongoing frustration for me that I'm able to observe and perceive so much more than I can get on paper. I really all the time feel that I'm up against my technical limitations. And I suppose that's what keeps an artist going, is wanting to improve. But I don't feel that I'm all that great at my craft. I'm a strong observer. But that really is my skill.
Nezhka, it's quite something to have this show and the start of the tour. You've seen the images. So what are the ones you're particularly drawn to?
Oh, it's interesting. Well, you know, I'll be honest, some of the people I didn't recognize because they're from another decade of importance, I guess. So even though I think I recognize a lot of them, there were a few that were from other walks of life that I don't necessarily follow. And it's just interesting to see people who, particularly growing up in New York and living in New York for a while, you know, some of the big New York personalities that have since become national ones, watching those kind of personalities sort of jump out of the frame of just being in New York City and now affecting a lot of people around the world even. So it's really kind of amazing to watch the development not only of the celebrity that John's focused on, but sort of seeing how he's seen them. So, and there's just a great diversity of artists and creators and people. The musicians particularly, I think, are interesting because some of them might be people that not everybody's understanding. And even you've got some historical characters in there, like Schubert, who, you know, you clearly wouldn't
Schubert,
have seen.
Anton Bruckner. No one has ever seen a caricature of Anton Bruckner.
What was the impetus for Anton Bruckner?
Well, the impetus for all of these was illustrating a story. In that case, it was a review of a recording of Bruckner's work. I illustrated Leon Wieseltier's music column for many years for Washingtonian. But the show does have diversity, and that's what's fun about it. It's, you know, everything from Jimmy Fallon and Donald Trump to Edith Wharton and Flannery O'Connor and Evelyn Waugh. So there's something for everybody, really. And it's always fun to draw those historical figures, too, because there's a certain freedom involved. You study the photos, but there's nothing in the back of my head saying, oh, this is how so-and-so did it or drew this person.
There's a whole trayload of Anton Bruckner over there, and it was only because he composed in long form that we don't hear more of him, but we know he was thought to be tedious.
That's right. Well, and I researched him. I studied him when I did that particular portrait, and one of the things that I learned is that he was considered a plodding, tedious genius, and I tried to get that into my portrait of him. He's standing there, you know, somewhat preposterously with his hand on his lapel, striking a pose, and he looks just lugubrious as can be.
I'd also like to just mention, of course, we actually have another artist who's also going to have work up at the same time, and often when we're planning our calendars, it's how can we kind of complement, have each exhibition complement one another, and we have another solo show. It's going to be of an artist who's from New York, Lenny Levinson Wiener, and the exhibition is called Park Bench Stories. So she, too, is observing, and she actually observed people. She's very much a people watcher. I think I can totally relate to this, you know, watching people go by, sit on the bench, sit on the step somewhere. And she would snap photos of people doing things and from all over the world. She's got a few continents covered in some of these snaps that she took. Well, what she decided to do was, as she was sorting these images, she realized she had caught a lot of people on park benches. And so what is it that people do in different countries on park benches? So that's where Park Bench Stories gets its name. And there's definitely a park bench that features. But what she's done is interpreted these groupings, these observations of groupings and people on park benches in fabric. And she's created these beautiful, incredible textural, for lack of a word, fabric paintings, because the meticulousness and the detail that she expresses with fabric is really quite remarkable. And you get this different sort of personality to the groupings or the solo people that are sitting on the park benches in various poses and sort of looking at her or not looking at her, or, you know, how many people are looking at their phones. And so what's also really wonderful is both John and Lenny will be on site at the museum on March 22nd for a very special reception. So that'll be actually the time that you'll get to talk and get sort of a tour with either one of the artists. Both of them, in fact, they'll be giving multiple tours that evening, and we'll have that information on our website with the details of the ticket costs and so forth. Again, that's March 22nd on the museum's website, www.everhart-museum.org.
Neshka Pfeiffer, curator at the Everhart Museum, and John Casht, celebrated caricature artist, with a cameo by Katharine Hepburn, speaking with us about the exhibition Making Faces, Portraits by John Casht, opening tomorrow, February 2nd, running through May 7th at the Everhart Museum, Naog Park in Scranton. There will be a First Friday event there tomorrow from 5 to 8 p.m. John Casht will be on hand in the museum shop, and that's free and open to the public. That's tomorrow, 5 to 8 p.m., the Everhart Museum, Naog Park in Scranton. Running concurrently, the show Park Bench Stories, featuring fabric collage pieces by Lenny Levinson Wiener, also through May 7th. There will be a special event, as Neshka told us, March 22nd. John Casht and Lenny Levinson Wiener will be on hand at the museum to conduct tours, beginning at 6 o'clock, Thursday, March 22nd. Also, John Casht will be taking part in the new Everhart Conversation Series, Tête-à-Tête, and that's in April. Check the website for details. Everhart-museum.org, everhart-museum.org. Making Faces, Portraits by John Casht, February 2nd through May 7th. And there will be a First Friday event tomorrow evening, 5 to 8 p.m., the Everhart Museum of Natural History, Science and Art, 1901 Mulberry Street in Scranton. For more information on the web, everhart-museum.org.